This week's show will go to Winnipeg, Manitoba, where the multi-million dollar Da Vinci Xi surgical robot could change the game for the province.
I used to work at the Mayo Clinic, and the sign over top of each door said the only interest to consider is the interest of the patient. So that's what this does. It's highly accurate, precise care through minimally invasive incisions.
In Ontario, the Toronto Palm House Conservatory greenhouse reopens after a three-year-long restoration project.
Our first relatives out there are the plants, the animals, the trees, the waters. So we give gratitude for that.
No walk in the park, an audit highlights pedestrian safety concerns around a new Nova Scotia library.
All of the evidence shows that walking is the most common form of activity, and one of the barriers to walking for many people is safety.
We'll stay on the East Coast, where 73-year-old Herb Nash has been fishing lobster for six decades. He says he does not intend to quit anytime soon.
As long as I'm walking, I'll be fishing.
And then we'll cross over to the other coast, where the world's largest Nanaimo bar sets a new record. Thousands got a piece of a finger-licking good 70-foot-long dessert.
It is not the Victoria Bar. It is not the Saskatoon Bar. It is not the Ottawa Bar. It is the Nanaimo Bar.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to you all. My name is Boris Hassan, and I'll be with you for the next half hour with the help of our journalists posted in BC, Manitoba, Ontario, and Nova Scotia this week. And that will be our point of entry. We'll put on our running shoes and stay close to Hike Nova Scotia, which held a walk audit around the new Liverpool Library this week. Some people have warned the new location could be dangerous for pedestrians. So a group of 15 people bad weather and traffic to get an idea of how safe it is for walkers around the city's library. Hike Nova Scotia held the audit at the request of the Region of Queens. The organization has so far conducted close to 15 audits around the province through its NS Walk program. But this was the first one for them in Liverpool. People walked a 2-kilometer route, and when they got back to the library, they were asked to rate the route on various factors, such as traffic, sidewalks, crosswalks, and safety. Rick Conrad put on his walking shoes to bring this back to us.
About 15 people braved some cool and wet conditions and traffic on Tuesday afternoon to get an idea of how safe it is for walkers around the new Liverpool Library location. Hike Nova Scotia held a walk audit in the area. Program manager Catherine Drosbeck said the organization has done about 15 of the audits around the province through its NS Walks program, but this was the first one for Liverpool.
Today was about responding to a request from the municipality, who is interested in looking at how we can continue to encourage folks to use active transportation to get to and from the local library. But we've been doing walking audits now for the past 9 months or so all over the province in communities big and small, who again are all interested in improving the experience for pedestrians in getting around their community. And then we've been going in and kind of helping them do the audit, which gives us some good data in terms of people's experience, but also it's a great way to engage community with government officials and other organizations to bring people together and say, this is what we love about our community, but this is how we like to make it better.
Morgan McDonald is the new physical activity coordinator for the Region of Queens.
All of the evidence shows that walking is the most common form of activity. It's accessible to people. It has much lower barriers. And one of the barriers to walking for many people is safety. So having a walkability audit allows us to take a certain portion of the region, which is around our new library location in Liverpool, and looking at the accessibility and the barriers to active transportation around this location and tying it into the existing infrastructure of the town of Liverpool. So by trying to address some of the barriers to people walking and rolling, we're hoping that they'll feel comfortable and confident to make that part of their everyday life.
People walked about a 2-kilometer route from the library off White Point Road through some nearby residential streets and back. When they got back to the library, they were asked to rate the route on various factors, such as traffic, sidewalks, crosswalks, and safety. When Regional Council decided to move the library from downtown to the new location, residents were concerned about safety because the area has no sidewalks and limited lighting. Sylvia Hurley of Liverpool says she loves to walk, but it can sometimes be dangerous.
And I have a lot of concerns about areas of walking, crosswalks, how walkers are treated locally, not stopping at crosswalks, not paying attention to us. I guess that's the main reason I came out. I wanted to express my concerns big time. I used to walk out on this street, but haven't walked here for a very long time. It's dangerous, very dangerous. It's narrow. But I'm fortunate because I can come up George Street from my house and be to the library, which suits me. I don't have to come out onto this road. So, yeah. But not everyone's is that fortunate.
Hurley said she thinks the walking audit is a great idea.
But if we're going to do an audit, honor what people say. Don't just, oh, yeah. They complained about this, they complained about that.
After the walk was over, participants ranked the route out of a score of 120. Most were in the 40 to 50 range, with one as high as 92. Some of the participants said that even though there are no sidewalks on roads around the library, the shoulders are wide enough in some areas for walkers. But they added that the unevenness of the unpaved shoulders would make it difficult for people in wheelchairs to navigate. They also talked about the lack of clearly marked crosswalks on the route and suggested installing crosswalk flags at certain intersections. Hike Nova Scotia's Drosbeck said responses from the walk audit will be compiled in a report to the municipality.
I think we identified some, what we'll call low-hanging fruit today, that the community can do that will go a long way to make people feel safer when they're walking this particular route. So whether it's marking the crosswalks better, looking at speed limit signs, some benches and things that will make it look more like, okay, people want to walk here and walk safely. So I think there's some possibilities there.
The region's Morgan McDonald said this was only the first of a few community consultations about active transportation, including walking and cycling. More are planned this summer in Caledonia, Greenfield, and again in Liverpool. He said the results of this week's walk audit are important to highlight for regional staff and council the community's concerns about walking in the area.
So it was sort of looking at how all of these different systems interact and how we can make infrastructure and spaces that work for everybody and encourage healthy activity and safe activity in our community.
I'm Rick Conrad.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
So this is really something to be seen, a surgical robot that can operate on you. It's not very discreet, and by looking at it, you would really think it has two left hands. It's a big fellow, looks like a giant tarantula, all dressed in black and gray metal. This multi-million dollar surgical robot has a name. It's called the Da Vinci XI Surgical Robot. It was acquired by the Manitoba Health Sciences Center. It will be a game changer for the patients, and it will have a snowball effect for the province. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
As part of its initiative to improve healthcare for Manitobans, the Health Sciences Center, HSC, has added its first surgical robot. This multi-million dollar Da Vinci XI surgical robot will have a snowball effect for the province, says Dr. Edward Bichelle, a surgeon and the site lead for surgery at HSC. He says one of the most significant impacts will be on the patient level.
I used to work at the Mayo Clinic, and the sign over top of each door said the only interest to consider is the interest of the patient. So that's what this does. It's highly accurate, precise care through minimally invasive incisions. It allows us to resect tumors that potentially might not have been resectable. So it can give life back to a person who was not offered that before.
Dr. Gilly Akhtar Dinesh, a thoracic surgeon at HSC, describes the da Vinci Xi's advantages as considerable.
The important distinction with minimally invasive surgery is that we take operations that are traditionally done through big incisions and make multiple small incisions. They're usually about 10 to 15 millimeters, and use specialized equipment through those small incisions to perform the operations.
Other minimally invasive equipment is inflexible, explains Dr. Akhtar Dinesh. It can only move in one or two dimensions. However, the new surgical robot's instruments are wristed, mimicking the movements of the human wrist, and rotate 360 degrees, allowing for delicate operations.
From my perspective, it's a game changer, at least for thoracic surgery. There are many operations that we have been able to do since starting our robotic program, which we would not have attempted to do through the traditional minimally invasive techniques, and also operations that would have been even difficult to do through open surgery.
Smaller incisions mean a quicker recovery for patients. A quicker recovery means less time in the hospital. Dr. Bushell says this means people who are on disability leave can return to work faster. Less time in hospital beds means a reduction in bottlenecking of emergency rooms and surgery.
Hospital beds are expensive. We don't have the staff to staff them. We don't have the place to build new beds. So we need to utilize our bed base very effectively. This robot utilizes. It decreases the utilization of those beds dramatically. We can pull out of the emergency room quicker. That decreases the workload on the emergency room. That decreases the wait time in the emergency room. We can also now bring more patients into the hospital off our surgical wait lists. So that directly helps secondary patients.
The robot also improves the recruitment and retention of trained surgeons. Dr. Bushell explains they were able to recruit Dr. Akhtar Dinesh, who joined the team right after her fellowship, because of the implementation of this technology.
We get to keep our kids, our neighbors, our relatives in our province so that the best that we have here don't go to Ontario or BC because we have the best equipment.
The robot, which has been funded by the HSC Foundation's Operation Excellence campaign in partnership with the province of Manitoba, has already performed around 100 surgeries and is used 5 days a week. Dr. Bushell says he is pleased with how the technology has impacted the hospital so far and how it will continue to benefit HSC's various departments, from urology, gynecology, oncology, and expansions into general surgery. I'm Ryan Funk.
You can find a picture of the da Vinci Xi surgical robot on frequencynews.ca.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
The Palm House Conservatory at Allen Gardens in Toronto officially reopened its doors to the public. The three-year-long restoration project is now complete. $11 million was injected into the project. The glass greenhouse has undergone extensive renovations to maintain the historic building's architectural heritage since closing in October 2022. Here's Mia Johnson in Toronto, Ontario.
Today, we are proud to officially open the Palm House.
The site got its million-dollar makeover it's been asking for, a restoration project to maintain its architectural heritage. Its 12-meter-high, 16-sided central dome you may have seen walking by on the streets of Sherbourne or Carleton is an iconic feature of the building. It's where it earned its nickname, the Dome. Under its roof is a collection of palms, banana plants, and other tall specimens fit for the pavilion's tall structure. Councillor Chris Moyes in Toronto Centre has been a champion for the garden. He says the space is much more than just a park.
This is a park with deep civic roots, where voices have risen in solidarity, resistance, and hope. It's been a platform for progress, a home for movements, and a mirror of our city's evolving values. And that tradition continues today.
The opening ceremony began with a smudging led by grandmother Vivian Recklett.
Our first relatives out there are the plants, the animals, the trees, the waters. All of those beings that helped us to be able to nurture ourselves as a human. So we give gratitude for that. You see all the
smudging is an indigenous practice involving the burning of sweetgrass, sage, or cedar, sometimes tobacco. The act of smudging cleanses the physical and energetic space, purifying bodies and items deemed sacred to the person doing the smudging. In this case, it is the land, the plant life, and the water that grandmother Vivian gives her gratitude for.
I'm really, really honored that this garden has been restored.
To close out the ceremony, a performance of the honor song, sung by Kevin Chasing Buffalo. The song is performed at gatherings, celebrations, or events. Seeing as this was a celebration for plant life now protected and taken care of. Allen Gardens is a sacred landscape for many nations. Today, it is a sacred gathering place for Indigenous peoples from across Turtle Island. The Native Women's Resource Center of Toronto, its second home, is Allen Gardens. They run events and ceremonies in the park. Friends of Allen Gardens is a volunteer-based organization behind the revitalization project. In 2023, volunteers from Friends of Allen Gardens committed to supporting the Native Women's Resource Center, planting sacred medicines within the park.
I do a lot of work out in the community to bring about awareness of gratitude and love for Mother Earth and all the things that she does for us.
Since closing in October 2022, the glass greenhouse has undergone extensive renovations. Its rehabilitation cost the city just over $11 million. Upgrades included glass cladding replacement, window glazing, and modernizing the ventilation and air quality system and controls. Friends of Allen Gardens founder Michael McKelland made sure to thank the community at Wednesday's ceremony. He says Allen Gardens is one of the first public parks in the city.
At the time it opened, there were 40,000 people living in the entire city of Toronto. 40,000 people. Now there's 40,000 people in the immediate neighborhood. And we have to think of these parks, how they functioned then, and how we want them to function in the future. And they have to have a sustainability to them. They have to actually be part of the understanding of growing with the city.
The building houses tropical plants inside five climate-controlled greenhouses. But the Palm House is the oldest of the greenhouses at Allen Gardens. The original structure was destroyed in a fire in 1902. But it reopened and has expanded twice since then. It was designed by City of Toronto architect Robert McCullen in 1910. With roots in social justice, the Palm House was a place where many activists met throughout the 20th century. In 1960, poets and activists gathered in defiance of the city bylaw that banned public speaking in parks. And in 1974, Toronto's first Pride March began in Allen Gardens. Mayor Olivia Chow says the city is committed to preserving and protecting the pavilion's history for future generations.
When we can stop for a while and enjoy the beauty, it gives us more energy to move forward, to make the changes that we need to make for social justice. And that was what Allen Garden and this Palm House is all about.
This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
We move up to the coast and sail to Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, to meet up with fisherman Herb Nash, who just celebrated 60 years spent on the water. Nash says he's been fishing lobster for decades and doesn't plan on quitting anytime soon. The 73-year-old Glace Bay man recalls spending time with his father on the boats as a child, and he loved it so much he then quit school at age 13 to be a full-time fisherman. Nash loves to fish and will keep working as long as he is living, he says. He sailed through troubled financial times over the years, and now facing a 25% Chinese tariff on Canadian seafood, Nash says he's not too concerned about it because people who enjoy lobster will pay the luxury treat regardless of the price. Bill McCush in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, met up with Nash.
A popular Glace Bay lobster fisherman doesn't plan on calling it quits anytime soon. Herb Nash has spent a lot of time on the water, going back to when he was a youngster in the company of his father.
I liked it, so as soon as I'd done it, I knew I liked it. And my father was a coal miner, but he fished part-time, him and this another guy that was a coal miner. They had 75 or 80 traps between the lobster traps, and they used squilt jigging and that, so it's aboard the boat. Like, whenever he was going, he had to take me with him because there were too many kids home. Border boats at those three or four, so I grew up on the boat.
As the years went by, Nash would work on the boats when he could. He realized as a teenager, school was not for him. Fishing became his livelihood and his passion.
What year is this? 2025. I'll be 74 in September, so yeah, I'm a few months away from 74. So, and I've been fishing since, well, like I quit school when I was around 13. They sent me back the next year, but only went for a week, and then I quit. I was on the draggers, and I took a trip off, which is 10 days. So I came home from PEI, went to school, and done my tour 3 days, got kicked out, and went back on the boat the next trip.
Nash says although he enjoys his work, his routine isn't exactly a 9 to 5.
We get up 3:15, and I leave the house here around 4:00, and time we get down the harbor and we're ready to leave, it's like 4:30, and we steam out, and usually we go to our farthest gear, so that takes an hour, so by the time we get there, it's 5:30, so it's bright enough to see and everything. So we start hauling, and usually about 1:30, 2:00, we're done for the day.
Nash talks about a day at the office hauling up a sizable catch. Here is the daily estimates.
Most people get like between 700 and 1,200 pounds, like depending on how deep their traps are and if their traps are where the lobsters are at that time. So it varies from 700 to 1,200, but then it don't last long. Like, after 2 or 3 weeks, it dies down to 40, 50 pounds coming on the end of it, eh?
Prices typically dip in May as the spring lobster season swings into high gear and buyers anticipate a boost in supply, but this season is different. On March 10th, China announced a 25% retaliatory tariff on Canadian seafood in response to Canadian duties imposed last fall on Canadian-made electric vehicles, steel, and aluminum. The Chinese tariff rises to 41% when a value-added tax is imposed. Nash says, however, he's not too concerned about that.
I don't really think it's going to matter a whole lot to us. I don't think we're going to see a big letdown because of it, like, eh? If people want lobsters, they'll pay whatever the price is, and if they, you know, it's a luxury, so they only have it once in a while. It's not something to eat every day. It's not like buying meat at the grocery store. You need it, meat and potatoes pretty well every day, but like lobsters is more or less a treat for them.
Nash says every year brings uncertainties when it comes to prices, but he says he just keeps heading out every season doing what he does best, leaving the administrative worries on shore for the time being. And if you ask him, how long will he be a fisherman?
Until I die. As long as I'm walking, I'll be fishing.
Nash says they'll probably get $8 per pound starting out this season, and he can live with that profit. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Well, while Nanaimo may be known for the city that races bathtubs into the ocean, there's something new the city is going to be known for now, and maybe forever. It now holds the record for the world's largest Nanaimo bar. No, not a counter to serve drinks. We mean like a chocolate bar, a never-ending dessert. The record-breaking bar was created by students at the Vancouver Island University Culinary Arts and Professional Baking and Pastry Arts Program. So on Saturday, May 17, thousands of people squeezed into the Windsor Plywood Trades Discovery Center to get a look and taste of the Nanaimo Bar. It ended up being 70 feet long, 32 inches wide. Do you want this in meters? Well, that's 21 meters long, 81 centimeters wide. It weighed 1,200 pounds or 544 kilograms and held 2.4 million calories, a bit much for a daily intake. Getting a taste for this story, here's Lauren McKenzie in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
The new record-breaking length for the bar, made in its namesake, was certified by both the Baking Association of Canada and the Culinary Federation of Canada, which represents the VIU trade students. To acknowledge the day, Nanaimo Mayor Leonard Croak spoke to the hungry crowd and proclaimed May 17th as Nanaimo Bar Day.
Friends, we are really lucky to live in this amazing community where we have this kind of enthusiasm, and I can only say it's only right and proper that we host the creation of the biggest Nanaimo bar in the history of the planet. It is not the Victoria Bar. It is not the Saskatoon Bar. It is not the Ottawa Bar. It is the Nanaimo Bar.
Once the bar was cut into almost 4,000 pieces, lines stretched around the Discovery Center as people waited to get a bite out of the record-breaking moment. And once people got to try the bar, it was fair to say it was a delicious record-breaking moment.
How is it?
It is fantastic.
It's really
very
good.
Very sweet.
Yeah.
And a lot better than I anticipated. Yeah.
Do you guys normally like Nanaimo bars?
We do. But we normally have like a little piece because it's so sweet normally time. But this, they nailed it. They nailed the custard and the chocolate and very good.
And we just moved here a few months ago. This is our first one here.
Yeah.
So how's that for perfect?
What an introduction to the environment, right?
Yeah.
And the community. Having a Nanaimo bar.
Yeah.
I tried it. It tastes pretty good. I didn't expect the piece to be that big, but it's pretty huge.
The VIU stamp of approval on it, too.
That's like a $5 Nanaimo bar.
Yeah, easily.
It's great, and it's creamy and delicious and rich.
I'd say for how big it is, it's one of the best ones I've ever had.
It's delicious.
It's really good. Delicious.
So really well awesome. Balanced. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you so much.
Really well balanced, I think.
Perfect. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Would you like to say how you thought?
Oh, you haven't tried it yet.
Oh, no, I'm really? Eating his. This, I'm taking this home to my mom in Campbell River.
Smart.
The authentic one, too.
No, it's my first Nanaimo bar. Yeah, so it's good. It's get a nice taste. And it's nice. I like it. Yeah. But it's sweet for me.
Too sweet? That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's good. I like it. Yeah. And it's fun being part of such a crowd and support the students. So it's good. Yeah. I like it.
It's awesome. It tastes great.
Would you like to say anything?
It's pretty good. Yeah.
Perfect. Great. Thank you so much.
Well, event goers were encouraged to grab a second piece in exchange for a donation to the culinary program. Any Nanaimo bars that were left over were packaged up, frozen, and donated to the Salvation Army in Nanaimo. This is Laura McKenzie.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our LGI journalists, Lauren McKenzie, Bill McCouche, Mia Johnson, Ryan Funk, and Rick Conrad. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for having us this week, and until the next, ciao. Thank you.
email is radio@frequencynews.ca. Radio@frequencynews.ca.